Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this lecture series on strategy. It's very kind of you to come out here. If you're interested in the series, then please Google Global Strategies at LSE. And Sir Lawrence Friedman is our first speaker. Might I just say, just before I introduce him, could I just mention two people to whom we are particularly indebted this evening? One is Gerald Griffin, who's our extremely generous benefactor, who is paying for these series of lectures. And the other is Gordon, who just introduced himself a moment ago, who has put in an enormous amount of effort, if I may say so, has prepared the program and has gone well beyond the call of duty in terms of enthusiasm and energy. These are two qualities for which I am not personally remembered. Now, why is Laurie, as we call him, here today? He's here today because he happens to be, I think, our leading strategic thinker in this country, and so he is by far the most appropriate person to start off the series. He also happens to have written one of the most important books on strategy. Some of you will be familiar with it, Strategy, a History, a publishing event when it came out. Now, may I embarrass you, Laurie, by reading out the extraordinary review you received in The Guardian for this book. An epic undertaking of considerable intellectual ambition, which displays the familiar Friedmanian, this is why I wanted to mention it, because you've actually coined an adjective, Friedmanian virtues, clarity, economy, proficiency, sagacity, a sort of professional sympathy, almost a delicacy of feeling for the subject, a compound of deep immersion, practical exposition, and practical wisdom. Wow. And those academics in the audience know that we are very sparing in the praise that we give to people when we review each other's books. So this is an extraordinarily fine review. I think the usual practice for academics reviewing books is to write the review first, and then if it's favorable, they might consider reading the book. Strategy is the art of creating power is one of the main things that emerges from that book. And those of you who know Laurie well know that he's actually been in the area of political power as a personal consultant to Tony Blair, as the author of his Chicago speech in 1999, as the official historian of the Falklands War, as a member of the Chilcot Committee. He will not be taking questions in the Q&A today on the Chilcot report, so please don't try to smuggle them in. But perhaps he may be talking in a year or two's time about the Chilcot Committee on another occasion, and hopefully in this place. And also, of course, he's been at the Centre of Academic Excellence in this country, a fellow of the British Academy and vice principal of King's College for many years. In fact, this is so impressive a record that it reminds me of the story that George Steiner tells about coming across Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic program in the United States, when he was a visiting fellow at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. And he, to his amazement, he heard Robert Oppenheimer shouting at one of his PhD students and saying, "You are so young, and already you have achieved so little." Now, I feel very much like that PhD student, although I'm not, unfortunately, young any longer. And on that embarrassing note, I'm now going to yield the floor.
Chris, thank you very much indeed for that. I'm not sure. The difficulty with an introduction like that is one can never quite live up to it, but thanks very much. So I'm going to talk a bit about strategy. The title is The Limits of Strategy, which indicates strategy is important, but it has limits. And I'm particularly going to spend time comparing and contrasting to contemporary strategists, one Vladimir Putin and the other Barack Obama, partly because both of them the strategic wisdom of both of them is a subject of constant debate as to whether Putin is a strategic genius or just getting his country into more and more trouble, and whether Obama is weak and continually missing the point and failing to understand the demands of international politics. to understand both of them and to understand both the questions, I think it is important to have a view about the limits of what strategy can and cannot do for you. Chris kindly opened by mentioning my definition of strategy, which is the art of creating power, which is important, I think, because it links, right from the start, strategy to power. It's not a plan, it's not a set of objectives and vague sense of how what these might be achieved. It is about the grasp of power and how you can extract more from a situation than your starting power might suggest. You start, we all have, in one sense, a general resource of power. Our assets. For a country, it's military power, it's economic power, and so on. And that leads you to expect certain results. But if you're a great strategist, maybe you can get more out of that than you would anticipate. But if you're a bad strategist, you get less. So that's one way of judging it. But it's to be judged by power, and it's the ability to appreciate power and wield it that seems to me the essence of strategy. It's also, for that reason, an executive function. There are plenty of people who can advise on strategy. There are plenty of people who will offer their services as strategic consultants. But in the end, the strategist is the one who has to make the decisions, where all the different factors are weighed together and they come out in a particular shape or form. Strategic advice is a different thing altogether. And I think there are one of the difficulties with a lot of strategy formation is, to some extent, this is subcontracted to a special department that produces strategies. Yet in the end, it has to be very much part and parcel of the everyday business of those who are responsible for making decisions. For that reason, a lot of good strategy may be quite intuitive. It's called experience or judgment. It's a grasp of the realities of power and the possibilities in particular situations that may be quite hard to put into words or maybe have to be appreciated under considerable pressure. But that is a key strategic asset, that you can have all departments producing clever things for you to do, but something will tell you that that's not going to quite work, that you're not going to be able to get away with it. And that's judgment and that's experience. And that without it, of course, very cunning and clever strategies may fall apart. Now, the reason, one reason we talk about strategy, one of the reasons I wrote a book about strategy, is that there is a constant demand for it. There's no human activity that isn't seen to be deserving of its own strategy, even quite intimate affairs. And now you can get strategies if you wish. We can have strategies for child rearing. We can have strategies for our tax affairs, as we can see at the moment, some of which work in the short term but can be quite embarrassing over the long term. You can have, and obviously government has strategies, it's got to have an energy strategy, it's got a climate change strategy, it's got to have a poverty strategy, it's got to have an economic strategy, certainly. It's got to have lots of different strategies. And that, of course, indicates one of the problems of strategy, is that all these strategies somehow have got to fit together, and often they don't, is that your strategy in one arena doesn't quite fit with your strategy in another. And that is the business of government. It's one reason why it's quite hard to produce these regular documents that are demanded of government in which they lay out their strategy, because somehow you've got to accommodate very many different aspects of policy life. And that when you start pushing very hard in one area, you suddenly realise that that actually gets in the way of another area. And this happens, obviously, quite recently. What may be your objectives with regard to sorting out our welfare system? What are your objectives with regard to sorting out our deficit? You can have a strategy on one, you can have a strategy on the other, but at some point they may clash. Now, the difficulty with the word strategy and the demand for strategy is it suggests somehow that if you've got it, you can make what is incoherent and complex and difficult and contradictory coherent. but you can pull it all together. The strategy is the magic ingredient that turns poor policy into good policy. And it's a word that's always carried an air of confidence about potential achievement around it. The word comes from the Greek strategos, the art of the general. Its basic themes developed over the centuries, normally under the heading of the art of war. And again, currency during the Napoleonic period as a suggestion that war could be guided by something more systematic than intuition and more reliable than military genius. There's a lovely line in War and Peace, which is the great anti-strategic book. The whole theme of Tolstoy, not only in War and Peace, but thereafter, was his contempt for people who thought they could manage human affairs and set directions for countries against the whole great man theory. Tell me he has the elderly Prince Bolkonski asking his son Andrei, tell me how the Germans have trained you to defeat Napoleon by this new science you call strategy. And it didn't take long before this idea of strategy gravitated from the military to the civilian sphere, from battles between armies to those between political parties to large corporations to sporting teams. Everybody has a strategy. So the weight of expectation around strategy was there from the start. And the original surges of enthusiasm for strategy in the different areas always began with confidence that with the right measures, demanding objectives could be achieved on a quite regular basis. The Napoleonic phenomenon led Jomini and Clausewitz to explain to aspiring generals through the 19th century and beyond, to even to now, how they could win decisive battles and so decide the fate of nations. The professional revolutionaries of the mid-19th century recalled the French Revolution to imagine equally decisive insurrections from which new forms of social order might emerge. Over a century later, the apparently unassailable great large American corporations led a new breed of experts in business management to identify organizational structures and concoct long-term plans to sustain this happy state of affairs. I mean, the origins of business strategy lie in the success of General Motors. Most of the original books were written about General Motors as it was in the middle of the last century. But in all of these cases, the initial confidence couldn't and didn't last. Victory in battle didn't necessarily mean victory in war. Ruling classes accepted reforms and deflected the masses away from revolution. The comfortable position of the American corporations was undermined by successive waves of competition. Nevertheless, so much strategic writing continues as if the decisiveness and control and predictability sought in the past might yet be found, if only the right formulations could be discerned. So this is our attempt to control the future by ensuring that current actions have the most desirable questions. That's why it's often assumed that the first requirement of strategy is a compelling vision for the future and then a plan to realise this vision, a sequence of steps that will enable one with confidence to move from one state of affairs to a better state of affairs. And the problem with any plan is that it assumes that the human inputs can be controlled and delivered. This is the difference between a plan and a strategy. If you get a flat box from IKEA, you need a plan to put it together. It can be very frustrating. You have to follow the instructions, and there's always a piece missing. But nonetheless, in the end, it's an engineering problem, not a strategic problem. If the box from IKEA contains parts which are willful, which sometimes they seem to be, which are willful, then you have a strategic problem. If they can decide to disappear, grow in size, not fill the holes on will, then that's a strategic problem. The problem with strategy is other people. The problem with strategy is other willful people who are often those who are supposed to be on your side, allies, partners, clients, not just your rivals and adversaries, who have their own ideas about what should be done, indeed their own strategies. The elder von Moltke expressed this very well when he said that no plan survives contact with the enemy. I opened my book with that other great strategist, Mike Tyson, who had a pithy version of the same point: everyone has a plan till they get punched in the mouth. So when all the moving parts and properties of all the moving parts, how they interact, are known, and none of them have an independent will, then we can have a plan. The problem with strategy is when the moving parts are not only not fully understood, but they have these independent wills of their own. Tom Schelling put it as interdependent decision-making. That is, it requires decisions that are affected by expectations about how others might act, which in turn depend on their expectations about how you might act. So it's important when one is considering strategy that we recognise that the key factors in whether or not it works will be all these other people and how they will respond. A successful strategy will require that other people act as expected, follow the script, allow themselves to be persuaded, manipulated, cajoled, coerced, controlled. And as soon as they deviate from the script, then you've got a problem. And this is why strategies need to be flexible and adaptable. Why they move on from the current situation, the problem at hand, by stages, hopefully in the direction you want to go, but in the process, new opportunities being opened up, so that you can achieve more than you originally anticipated, but as often as not, you will achieve less than you originally anticipated. But it will be different because you have interacted with other people and other people have produced their results. Now, I think this is relevant to the discussion I now want to move on to in terms of the comparing and contrast Obama and Putin, because one of the features of democratic societies is these other people are much more present and much more vocal and much more able to get in the way. The problems of strategy making in democratic societies are considerably greater than the problems of strategy making in authoritarian societies. A supreme leader who has managed to deal with all local opposition can get their way. Now, if it all goes badly wrong, that may be the end of the supreme leader, as often turns out to be the case. But while it's going well, they're even more supreme. Whereas democratic leaders are constantly going to be seen to be a bit behind, to be reactive rather than active. Now, there's another reason for this, which I'll come on to in a second. But it's one of the things you will regularly hear comparing and contrasting Putin and Obama, that Putin is bold. Putin is the one who takes the initiative. He's proactive. Obama is following on behind, trying to work out what he's going to do and how best to respond. Now, I think in our minds, we have to work out whether democracy is an advantage to strategy making a barrier. The reason why it's an advantage, I'd argue, is it allows you to test your strategies. It allows you, if somebody thinks that's a bad idea, you'll hear about it. If they think it's a good idea, you'll get reinforcement. But there's a checks and balance process that may enable you, in the end, to get a better strategy than you would otherwise have. You also have to know that you can sell it to public opinion. I think you see this probably more clearly with an American president than a British prime minister, because American presidents are often don't have other politicians around them. They're often the main politician in the room when the National Security Council is meeting, and they're the ones who have to think about whether or not this is a policy that can be sold. You can see this very clearly with Kennedy. And I'm always struck by Ted Sorensen's observation from the Cuban Missile Crisis, that he was asked to write two speeches, one for a blockade and the other for airstrikes, and he found it almost impossible to write the airstrike speech. He couldn't quite get the arguments because they weren't very good. And that's quite a useful thing to know. So autocrats can make the big and bold decisions, but they can often be terrible decisions because they don't have to worry about autocracy, accountability, and those around them are scared to make a challenge. So that's one reason why you might expect Obama and Putin to have different approaches. Another reason is a difference between a status quo power and an insurgent power. There's always a demand in the West for grand strategy. Now, if you're a status quo power, a great day in the office is when nothing happens. You really don't want things to change. So for a status quo, what's the objective? Things should stay broadly as they are. You're not the one who wants to cause the disturbance. Somebody else is going to cause a disturbance. You want to know about that and deal with it, deflect it, squash it. But you're the one who wants things to carry on. Current trading system, open trading system, collections of alliances. These are the things that you believe produces stability and security and prosperity. If you're a British prime minister or an American president, or whatever, you look at the past 70 years and it really hasn't been too bad. You want things more or less to carry on. And when you do get tempted to push a bit harder, then trouble can ensue. Whereas if you're an insurgent or feel disadvantaged in the current setup, then you want strategy more, but you're going to be much more ambitious in what you want that strategy to achieve. This is why some of the most creative strategic writing has come from the revolutionary left, not necessarily in the pale imitations of the great figures that we now see around us, but going back to the 19th century, that is not a partisan political comment. going back to the great figures of the 19th century, who became social theorists because they were trying to work out why was it that the masses were so supine? Why did they seem to suffer from this false consciousness? How was it that power was retained? But the most ambitious strategies come from the radicals. This is why it can often be quite boring to study the strategies of those who are already very powerful. There's a famous line of Ecclesiastes that the fight doesn't always go to the most strong and the race doesn't always go to the most swift. But as Damon Runyon pointed out, they're the ones to bet on. because most of the time, the fight goes to the strongest and the race goes to the most swift. When it doesn't, they're the interesting cases. And so a lot of strategy is about developing cunning plans that allow you to somehow get round the strength of your opponent, or, and this is relevant also to what I'm going to talk about, to forge alliances. This is one theme in my book, is that the best strategic move is to forge a coalition, is to get more people on your side. For reasons, again, that I'm going to discuss in a moment, it can also be a pain. And I'm not looking at you, William. because coalitions, I think actually coalition in this country probably has a better name now than it did while it was happening. But the point about coalitions is that it's a way of countering the strength of another by just bringing somebody else in, not by having to be cleverer or smarter, just meeting their power. Now let me talk, go to this comparison of the two. So it's normally, as I've said before, an unfavourable contrast of Obama with Putin. Putin's bold, Obama's cautious, Putin changes the terms of trade, Obama has them turned against him, Putin breaks the rules while Obama sticks to them. The US is now in retreat in the Middle East. Russia's on the offensive. And the brilliance of Putin's strategy is often attested to in a number of admiring pieces, often, I would say, by those who feel that the West as a whole, and Obama in particular, has been taken for a bit of a sucker, and they feel a need to urge that this should be redressed. We've got to get wise. We've got to see what this guy is up to so we can beat him. This has been called Putin envy. And I want to quote just an example from this, just somebody you're writing yesterday in the Financial Times. The image of, this is Eugene Rumer, the image of Russia as weak and withdrawn from the international arena of its ruling elite focused on economic stability as a means of political survival is wrong. Moscow today has broader ambitions, greater resources, and a willingness when challenged to challenge its adversaries in return. That is what Mr. Putin has done in Syria, and it's only prudent to expect him to do so again. Handling of Syria shows ruthlessness, skill, determination, and judgment. Ignoring the brutality of President Bashar al-Assad, and with neither the US nor Europe willing to intervene in the civil war, he stepped into the vacuum and, deploying air power, changed the course of the conflict. Then he announced he was quitting the scene but left the door open to a return. Mission accomplished, then. Mr. Assad has been saved, and all parties of the civil war have been disabused of the idea that a military victory is possible, as if they had the idea before. In a bizarre twist, Mr. Putin's intervention paved the way for the first serious ceasefire in the war and possibly real peace talks. So it goes on. More broadly in the Middle East, Russia is back. It's at the centre of a complex web, including not only Syria, but all of the parties directly and indirectly involved in the larger conflicts in the region, including the US and the EU. Moscow cannot solve the region's problems, whose can? But now they cannot be solved without it either. So Russia's weaknesses are admitted, declining economy, inability to reform. Yeah, this is mentioned in order to demonstrate Putin's strategic acuity. And for the reasons I've given, that's fair enough. To create power out of weakness when you're weak is a strength. But it does raise questions about how we judge strategic success. And it's a difficulty with Putin because he doesn't actually tell us what his objectives are, except in quite general terms. And certainly when one looks at Ukraine, about which I don't think one can talk in sort of the glowing terms in which Mr. Rumer was talking about Syria, he's never quite admitted, apart from the annexation of Crimea, what he's up to and why. Indeed, there's another swathe of literature praising Putin and Russia more generally for hybrid warfare, its ability to confuse and perplex us by never quite telling us the truth. In fact, never tells the truth at all in some respects, as this is a critical and valuable part of its strategy. But it does make it very difficult to evaluate what's going on. Is this actually part of getting us confused and disoriented, trying to make sense of what he's up to? So let me offer my interpretation. It seems to me Putin's strategy is at heart defensive and born of insecurity. He's insecure about his own position, not in terms of popular elections, but a colour revolution. And he sees colour revolutions essentially as a NATO-EU plot, using popular discontent as a means of expansion. This has been his fear for over a decade in the space of the former Soviet Union, and provides the best explanation of a succession of policies and moves designed to hold back further expansion and provide an alternative in the Eurasian Union. Remember the Eurasian Union, a project which one hears very little about at the moment. So in that sense, his reaction to the fall of Yanukovych at the end of February 14 was the reaction to the loss of a client. It wasn't a bold move designed as an offensive against the Ukraine. Initially, it was a defensive move because somebody upon whom he had hoped to keep it in place had just been toppled or run away in practice. And I think Putin's objective was to foment a counter-revolution, and that's essentially failed. After all this effort, and this has been going on for some time now, he has Crimea, which he sort of had de facto anyway, and a bit of Donbass, which he can't quite now pass back to the Ukraine because he can't bring himself to meet all the Minsk criteria, or can't get the rebels to do so, or a combination of the two. And he's having to subsidise this bit of Ukraine, while Ukraine, admittedly with setbacks and difficulties, as we saw yesterday with the Dutch referendum, but nonetheless is getting closer to the EU, which is what he hoped to prevent in the first place. If that was his objective, to stop Ukraine getting close to the EU, he's clearly failed. He's acquired sanctions along the way, which he's not quite been able to shake off, despite confident predictions each time the EU comes up to renew them, that they will not be renewed. They keep on being renewed. And he managed also to make the sanctions worse by his own retaliation of banning imports into Russia. So, and then you have with the evidence of the disinformation strategy, the problems that resulted from MH17, the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner. If he had acknowledged the problem, and it wasn't very hard to explain what had happened, then that issue would be, so from July 14, would have been a year and a half away. But he didn't, he couldn't. So we're still debating this, it's still a live issue, and one preposterous claim after another about what really happened to the airliner has been discredited. And I think Putin realises this. I think Putin realises that the Ukraine policy has not been a great success because he doesn't talk about it that much anymore. It's not as much of a feature of his speeches as it was. And the talk that one saw in 2014 of the Russian pivot to China and so on, you don't hear much of that also anymore. Obviously, the collapse in the oil price has made a lot of difference. So if you're trying to judge the last couple of years of Putin, it doesn't look actually, in various criteria, certainly as far as Europe is concerned, very impressive. The economy from being, what, fifth, sixth economy in the world, it's now about 13th, on a par with Mexico. And the World Bank has just warned that even if sanctions are lifted, it's going to take many years to recover. Remember the role that Gazprom was going to play in European politics as an important lever of Russian foreign policy. Well, the main result of all of this is considerable loss of market share to Gazprom, which is now in real financial difficulties. Inward investment has dried up and there's been substantial capital flight. So one has to feel if this is strategic success, one would hate to see what failure looks like. On Syria, I think the situation's different. The starting point's the same. In this case, the aim was to help prevent the precipitate fall of a client, Assad, and preserve Russia's position in the country, the naval facility at Tartus, the air base in Latakia. And it worked diplomatically on Assad's behalf since 2011 to prevent UN pressure piling up on the Syrian regime. But last September, when Assad was looking increasingly vulnerable, he began a major air campaign, ostensibly directed against ISIL, but in practice designed to shore up Assad. Now, unlike in Ukraine, Russia's legal position is more secure, because he's supporting an existing government, however fragile. So there's no need for the sort of pretense that we've seen in Ukraine, although there was still the pretense when it came to who exactly they were targeting and when. And Russia has also claimed that it's been successful to the point of being able to withdraw to a degree, though he hasn't fully withdrawn, and many are inclined to agree. He has shored up Assad and used that as a basis to get peace talks going, in which it is a main player. He has helped to get a ceasefire, although that may be breaking down, and silenced some of his critics, as Assad was able to take back Palmyra from ISIL. Even Boris Johnson was impressed. There have been... you can't say in the same way I would say about Ukraine that he hasn't achieved his objectives. But it's had its costs. A heightened risk of terrorism, the loss of the Russian airliner from Egypt, and the collapse in relations with Turkey. Putin and Erdogan seem to me to be two of a kind. And a year ago, they seemed like natural soulmates. And Erdogan was being feted in Moscow, I believe opening a mosque in Moscow. So that's a cost. It's a serious one. And may have consequences for some time to come for both countries. And it's not altogether clear the durability of these achievements. which I think is the main question mark. If you go back to the article I was quoting from the FT before, the achievements, sure, Assad has been saved for the moment, but it's hard, still hard to imagine Assad presiding again over all of Syria. Disabused of the idea of military victory. Well, really, anybody who was looking at Syria and expected a military victory a year ago wasn't looking very hard when there are so many competing factions and the way in which they are interacting with each other. And now at the centre of a complex web in the Middle East. Well, it's certainly a complex web in the Middle East, but one might want to be in this web in the same way that a fly might want to be in a spider's web. You're caught. And I think that is the issue for Putin, is having committed himself to Assad in this way, or at least to the regime of which Assad is the figurehead. How long does this last for? So, leaving open those questions about the Middle East, because I think that's where we turn to on Obama as well. Let me now quickly move on to Obama. Now, Obama has declared himself unimpressed by what Putin is doing in Syria. And I think what I'm really going to rely on is a remarkable piece by Jeffrey Goldberg, which recently appeared in Atlantic magazine, based on numerous interviews with Obama, which obviously gives Obama his best case, but certainly doesn't suggest that he's a man without a strategy. It demonstrates that he has some quite clear strategic views. This is what Obama says about Putin. He understands that Russia's overall position in the world is significantly diminished, and the fact that he invades Crimea or is trying to prop up Assad doesn't suddenly make him a player. You don't see him in any of these meetings out there helping to shape the agenda. For that matter, there's not a G20 meeting where the Russians set the agenda around any of the issues that are important. They're overextended, they're bleeding, and their economy has contracted for 3 years in a row drastically. So that's a pretty clear dismissal. What's then Obama's strategy? Let me leave the Middle East to last, because clearly the key point about Obama's strategy is not to get involved in the Middle East to the extent he can avoid it. He thinks Asia Pacific is a much more exciting place in social and economic terms. It's where the main dynamism is. He's irritated by allies. He wants allies to do more. He thinks they're free riders, including us. And therefore, he's not averse to leading from behind, because he thinks that the allies should be pushed into doing more. As far as the Middle East goes, he's particularly irritated by the collection of allies he finds himself bequeathed. Quote, clearly irritated that political orthodoxy requires him to treat Saudi Arabia as an ally, which one can understand. Netanyahu is described as being in a category all of his own in terms of his ability, and Erdogan comes not to. I mean, this is a wonderfully indiscreet article, which you can only do when you don't expect to be president for not too much longer. Why does he think he can not worry so much about the Middle East? Because under his watch, American energy position has been transformed. America has become much more self-reliant because of Shell. Now, obviously, it's dependent upon markets, but it doesn't really need the Middle East. The big problems that are being caused affect Europe with refugees and so on, but as we've seen, the Americans, without having to build a wall, can keep themselves separate from some of those problems. And this all comes together when he talks about the decision in September 2013, which some would say was the worst of his presidency, which was not to follow through on the supposed red line he'd set on Syria using chemical weapons. And he doesn't deny that Syria had used chemical weapons. And what Goldberg says about this is that what is seen by many as being a major failure because of the damage it did to the credibility of the United States, that a country that bluffed, in a sense, and didn't follow through when the bluff was challenged, is that Obama sees it as his moment of liberation from, he calls beltway thinking. In particular, the idea that one must do stupid things for the sake of credibility. He defied the foreign policy establishment and what's called its cruise missile playbook, but also the demands of the various high-maintenance allies in the Middle East. This is what Obama says. I'm very proud of this moment. The overwhelming weight of conventional wisdom and the machinery of our national security apparatus had gone fairly far. The perception was that my credibility was at stake, that America's credibility was at stake. And so for me to press the pause button at that moment, I knew would cost me politically. And the fact that I was able to pull back from the immediate pressures and think through in my own mind what was in America's interest, not only with respect to Syria, but also with respect to our democracy, was as tough a decision as I've made. And I believe ultimately it was the right decision to make. Where am I controversial? When it comes to the use of military power, that is the source of the controversy. There's a playbook in Washington that presidents are supposed to follow. It's a playbook that comes out of the foreign policy establishment. And the playbook prescribes responses to different events, and these responses tend to be militarized responses. Where America is directly threatened, the playbook works. But the playbook can also be a trap that can lead you to bad decisions. In the midst of an international challenge like Syria, you get judged harshly if you don't follow the playbook, even if there are good reasons why it doesn't apply. Now, I think where Obama doesn't address the issue is why he made the red line statement in the first place. If he hadn't made that, much of this wouldn't be so problematic. But I think he's on strong ground when he said the reason that he had been elected was that, as he put it, don't do stupid stuff. Actually, a different word to stuff is used, but you know what I mean. That he doesn't want to get into the position where the US is trying to govern the Middle East. And he can also point out that there are other areas where actually slowly but surely he's been strengthening the American international position, again, often in controversial ways. Just try and imagine if a debate in, let's say, the old Soviet Union were at his point, something that way. Just, you know, Obama has made overtures to Cuba, to Iran, to Vietnam, to Myanmar, all of which have proved not unsuccessful, with varying degrees of success. Now, if that was being done against the United States, that would be considered to be quite a series of foreign policy defeats. Cuba is, to the very least, a long-standing ally of Moscow in Latin America, in Southern America. But he's done it. And the assumption now is whatever, and Fidel clearly himself can see the dangers, is that this will have eventually a transformative effect on Cuba, where while Venezuela, one of those up-and-coming countries of the past, led by a radical socialist, praised by some of our own politicians, is now in deep, deep trouble, serious, catastrophic trouble. Now, what conclusions can we draw from all this? First, I think Obama is a better strategist than Putin, but Obama has got strengths that Putin doesn't have. But it creates an issue. And it creates an issue precisely in this area where he finds the Middle East, but also other areas, uncomfortable, which is the role of allies. The big difference, why we're not going back to Cold War II or anything, the big difference is that the United States is at the is part of a web, a network of alliances, about 70 different countries, one way or the other, the United States has security arrangements with, many of them tight allies with Article 5 obligations. And that's the difference. And that number has grown. The reason why it's not Cold War 2.0 is because in the Cold War, the Soviet Union had a whole load of allies who are now allies of the United States. And indeed, many bits of the Soviet Union are now, or a number of bits of the Soviet Union are now allies of the United States. The Soviet Union, sorry, Russia doesn't have allies. Or for that matter, does China? North Korea, maybe, but hey. So the challenge for a status quo president, more or less satisfied with the world as it is, realistic about using military power, is that so much depends on maintaining this network of alliances. And that seems to me the problem and the challenge posed by Obama's strategy, not because it's particular to Obama, but because it's not an unreasonable strategy for an American president to hold. Without wishing to get into the current crop of presidential candidates, you don't see any of them particularly, with the possible exception of Hillary, but even she's being more careful, arguing for a more adventurous American role. If anything, the arguments are for less. And so if this is the case, then you have a creeping challenge to the way that strategy has been understood in the Western world for some time. So I said about the limits of strategy. And what's interesting about Obama is that's what he understands. The whole article that I've been quoting from is in effect about the limits of strategy. You can't expect to govern other countries that you don't understand and with which you feel no natural empathy. You don't want to be continually being at the beck and call of political leaders whose systems you really don't like and, as far as you can see, are acting against their country's best interests. You know that armed force is going to produce limited results, except where you can, from the start, limit what you can do. Nobody can accuse Obama of not being prepared to use armed force. Nobody has almost, looking at a list, he's a most unusual political leader in the number of people whose death warrants he has effectively signed through drone strikes. But that's at a distance. It doesn't involve boots on the ground. Now, if this is the case, if that is an awareness at the top of the American system of the limits of strategy, that has really important implications for the rest of us. Because by and large, we have relied on the Americans not being quite so conscious of the limit of strategy, of making promises and offering guarantees and assurances that to some extent, fortunately, we never had to test, but pose that issue of credibility all the time. The number of references in this article to free riders is quite striking. We have to do more ourselves. So the conclusion is that looking from the American side, we have to do more strategically. So though strategy has its limits, and we have to be aware of those ourselves, we can't assume that it's only going to be the Americans who are going to be running up against those limits in the future. But I'll stop. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Laurie. I think you prefer to stand, and we're going to open up the floor. We've got about 20 minutes for questions, and it would be great if you could identify yourself. Obviously, you know most of the people in this audience, but not everybody knows each other. There's also a microphone going around, and if you could just say who you are and identify your institutional affiliation, that would be wonderful as well. So could I throw it open? Who would like to be first here?
Laurie, I'm interested in your... Jonathan Powell. What is the distinction you draw between strategic and tactical? Because I always think of Putin as tactical rather than strategic. He grabs opportunities. His sport is judo. What he likes is the counterpunch, to use someone's strength against them. And that's why he gets himself into trouble in places like Donbass. He's brilliant at grabbing an opportunity, brilliant at wrong-footing people, surprising people. But you couldn't really describe a strategy for Russia if he's trying to achieve a more prosperous and successful Russia.
I'm sure he thinks that's what he'd like. I think the distinction between tactics and strategy is a dodgy one. I mean, it essentially is one that derives from levels of command. And even with levels of command, you now talk about the strategic corporal, because decisions, as you can see with Putin, I don't disagree with how you're describing how the decisions are taken, but they're certainly strategic in their consequences. They're big decisions. I mean, to invade another country is a pretty big decision if you're doing it a bit on impulse, or because, you know, it occurs to you in a moment of desperation, this is all I can do. And because, you're using the levers you've got, which are not very many. So I'm not sure it's useful to think about the distinction between tactical and strategic, but I think what is clear, it's quite short term. And I think the problem with Putin is the problem of the first move, which is a standard problem in strategy, is you take a bold first move and everybody gasps with awe and astonishment at the brilliance of the first move. But actually, you haven't really thought through the second and the third and the fourth. And I think that's his problem. And I think you can see both with Ukraine and Syria, a realization at some point that he... Oops, nothing broken. A realization, an expansive gesture. A realization at some point that he needs to stand back, that he needs to pull back a bit, because this is why I don't buy, all this stuff. He's bound for the Baltics. I mean, if he wanted to take Ukraine, he had his chance and he didn't take it. I mean, Ukraine would not have been able to resist that easily in the summer of 14, but he didn't take it. I think he is actually aware of the limits of Russian power and is trying to maximise the impact, but he hasn't. But his problems come not with the first step, but with the later one, which I think fits in with what you're saying.
William Wallace, I first had an enjoyable discussion with Lowy in 1968, January 1968, as I recall. Lowy, nobody mentioned China, no. Or just in passing, and I would have thought, if we're talking in global strategic terms, the question of global shift and how we accommodate ourselves to the rising powers, above all China, India to a much lesser extent, are the underlying issues. I had a Japanese visitor the other week who was excoriating on the absence of strategic thinking in Europe about the rise of China and how we cope with East Asia. But the Americans have that on their front desk, and they have to think about it. I'd love to hear what you think of the Obama administration record strategically towards East Asia.
I don't think it's that bad. I mean, I think... So, you're right. I mean, I didn't talk about China. Xi's strategy is interesting too, and also quite hard to discern in some ways, because they've become more authoritarian, but it's in a different position from Russia. I mean, the interesting thing I found about China recently international economic policy, where, in a sense, it's the problem of a vanguard communist party, who was still taught in those ways, trying to manipulate capitalist economics.
That was the lecture I was giving the first time.
I think it probably was. If I remember, I was there to disrupt it, though. So making sense of China itself is a challenge. So China, it seems to me, its main priority must be to maintain its economic growth. There's clearly, as within Moscow, a concern about political control and how one holds on to it. And I think, without knowing that much about it, Xi is playing a very high-stakes game at the moment with the anti-corruption campaign. And the latest Panama disclosures probably won't help him in that, when people close to him get fingered in that way. I think the idea of the inexorable rise of China, as if 10-12% growth rates will happen every year, is now obviously dented. So there's a more realistic appreciation of China and its problems. But clearly what China is trying to do is to assert its historic rights, what it believes to be its historic rights, in the South China Sea, with Japan. And this creates a risk of clashes. And I think the Americans were right to put more effort into Asia-Pacific. And I think they've had some success as a result. They've steadied things amongst a number of their allies. But there are enormous risks for them in this. For example, the current overtures to Vietnam, which even include the possibility of bases. Well, you know, it seems to me there's an analogous position between Vietnam and Ukraine. Japan is an American ally. Vietnam isn't. So what are America's responsibilities if China keeps on pushing against Vietnam? How much does it help Vietnam push back? And I don't think it's under an obligation to do so, but the very fact of getting closer may make the Vietnamese themselves feel able to take more risks. So I think there, you know, before, at the start of 2014, I assumed that the most challenging moments in international politics were about to come in Asia, which shows how much I know. That's what you were expecting, an incident at sea of some sort, of considerable, you know, because it just set up for it. And that's still a serious possibility. So I think the challenge for the Americans is how far are they going to go? Now, I think, you know, I've been subject to the same speeches from the Japanese about Europe's negligence on this issue. You can point out Australia is as far away from China as we are, but Australia still seems to be able to take a keen interest in what's going on there. And we should too, because it affects us. I mean, the list of shocks to the international economy, a war involving China seems to me to go quite high on the list. So we should be taking an interest. But our tendency, including in this government, to treat China basically as an economic opportunity, which, as we're seeing, also can produce its own problems, but that tendency means that we're missing out on a lot of this. And we've got to think, you know, we have good trading relations, other relations with the Japanese, and so on. We have to take a view on the region as a whole. But I think Europe has opted out of that. I think it's a mistake. I think we should be involved. It still raises the question of what we can do about it. I mean, as a matter of fact, in terms of military presence, and we're going to be stretched enough, it seems to me, with the Middle East and NATO. So there's limits on what we can do, but we should still at least have views, take an interest, get involved, look at a number of the issues that are bubbling up in the area, and not just leave it to the Americans to sort out.
Interesting.
Well, my name is Stephen Fortescue. I'm from the University of New South Wales in Australia. I won't talk about China. I'm actually a specialist on Russian domestic policy.
Right.
And it's been quite irritating to me, in fact, that as a result of Ukraine and so on, we've all been forced to become specialists on foreign policy and international relations, which is quite frustrating and irritating. But what I wanted to say was in response to your... You were responding to a question, and you said about Putin's first move problem. And one thing about Russia as a policy-making society, or whatever you want to say, is it is incredibly bureaucratic. It has an incredible number of think tanks developing strategies and programs, and constantly. It's very hard for me to believe that Putin and his advisers haven't thought beyond the first move. In fact, they've thought beyond the second move and the third move. They're very big. They always have multiple scenarios. I suppose my feeling is that, in fact, they're so strategic that their strategies end up being plans. And you said at the beginning that you don't want to have a plan. They have, if this happens, go there. If that happens, go here. If that happens, go there. and it ends up as a plan, not a strategy, and that might be where they're getting themselves into some problems.
That's interesting. I think, I'll say this. Let's take Crimea. There's lots of evidence that the Russians had plans for Crimea. They even talked about them because it was a way of putting pressure on the Ukrainians when Yanukovych was in charge. The Poles have talked about this as well. So there's no doubt, and it obviously wasn't a very difficult thing, given you've got a base there to take over Crimea. So they had a plan to do that. But the circumstances, I mean, this wasn't a sudden, waking up one moment and thinking, I'll take Crimea. It was things going incredibly badly wrong for Putin in Ukraine. It was a series of events that seemed to be getting completely out of hand. And that's when he moved. And initially, as you will recall, he said he wasn't annexing Crimea, and a week later he decided he was. Now, that doesn't seem to me to suggest... So the plan was there. They had that. But I think the move was quite impulsive. And I think that fits. So I don't think the difficulty with strategic plans of this sort, I think Schlieffen plan, is there. They never quite are implemented in the circumstances for which they're designed. And I think that's probably what went wrong.
Right, just went over there.
Christian Turner from the Foreign Office. A variant on the last question, and Jonathan's on tactics against strategy. I mean, it seems that we think of strategy as a statement of mastery and as an authoritative, almost total control. And actually, your conclusion on the limits is much more modest. It's almost about a coping mechanism and a way of muddling through. Is that right and fair conclusion to draw from what you're saying, do you think? And if so, is there actually so much difference between what Putin and Obama have been doing?
It's a fair conclusion. With regard particularly to the Middle East, I wrote a book on the Middle East, American Policy in the Middle East, came out in 2008-09. In which I said, this is a place you can manage, but you can't. You can't reshape. So there are some parts of the world where it's about mitigation and alleviation and managing and coping. So other places, I mean, not all strategies fail. I mean, we can think of, but the strategies that seem to me to be most successful build up into success. It's not that they set themselves great objectives, is one thing, you create a virtuous cycle. I mean, I always cite Singapore as an example of Lee Kuan Yew turns out to have been a brilliant strategist. And I think his basic thing was that every time a challenge came, he got a little bit more ambitious. But, he would claim that he was being pragmatic and just dealing with one problem at a time. But the cumulative effect was positive. And you think of it, the point is not that all strategies will fail, because clearly many succeed, but the circumstances, but you have to work with the circumstances, and the circumstances in the Middle East are particularly hopeless, it seems to me. It's just it's a graveyard of foreign policies. Everybody gets it wrong, including the countries that live there. It's hard to, there are moments when countries are successful, but it passes. I've discovered you never go far wrong by being pessimistic. It's a bleak view. And they're a good thing, it's not that it's all, there are good things happening in the Middle East as well as bad things. It's not that the whole region is doomed or awful. But it's very difficult because the conflicts within the region are so cross-cutting. You try to work out what, just look at Syria. You want to deal with Turkey and the Kurds at the same time. You've got the Sunni. You're having a deal with Iran on the nuclear, but Iran is trying to shore Assad up. The Saudis. Furious with Iran and are running their campaign. But they're trying to talk with the Russians because they're worried about the need to deconflict. And when they go into Yemen, which is showing their sort of bout of muscular independence, they get themselves into trouble. It's a very, very difficult part of the world in which to work your way through. And you say you should work with the grain of these regions, but the grain is very knotty in that part of the world. So it's a dismal conclusion in some ways, but the muddling through argument is at least for the moment. I mean, we had hopes in 2011 that things may change. But the fact is, it's a history of strong men. And the problem that we've had is strong men, or men, have one generation reached their sell-by date, they failed, they collapsed, and nobody yet has been able to establish the authority, Sisi's tried, to run their countries. So it's a really, in some ways, quite a scary situation. But it's quite specific. I mean, I'm probably going a bit over the top here, but I don't think I'm going too over the top in the concern. Now, even last missed in Africa. I mean, in Africa, again, you've got different patterns of possibilities and hopes and things that can be done. In some ways, it's been easier to intervene in Africa than it has been in the Middle East. So, I don't think this isn't a sort of a general counsel, don't try anything at all, hopeless, you're bound to fail, let's give up. It's just warning the limits, that you can do things, but there are limits.
I'm afraid we've only got time for one more question.
You've just snubbed my boss, so I think you should...
Sorry.
So you should...
Two more questions in that case, yes.
Okay, thank you. Peter Hill, Director of Strategy in the Foreign Office, although I'm going to change my title tomorrow to Director of Muddling Through, I think, is probably... one comment and one question. So my comment was whether you perhaps underplayed... So I completely understand that in public policy, strategy is often used as a synonym for planning. But I just wonder if you perhaps underplay the importance of that for aligning a lot of cats and a lot of resources in a broadly similar direction. It's quite a organising in democratic systems where you can influence, persuade, perhaps at the margins coerce, but you can't control and force is quite a big challenge in and of itself. So that was my comment. My question was what you said about strategies of status quo powers and the characterization of the United Kingdom and I guess the United States as status quo powers, and just whether you could unpack that a bit, because obviously it's contestable. I suppose if I'm sitting in Moscow or Beijing, the United States and the United Kingdom don't really look to me like status quo powers. They look rather like revolutionary powers. And I think the status quo is not a fixed thing, and that if we thought there was a trajectory of status quo post-89, I think we're probably a bit less confident than we were about the nature of that status.